then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I've heard orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's March the 28th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Now, this is one of those weeks that I'm simply rushed off my feet. For one thing, it's the end of the month, and I've got the April Northwest Observer to produce and mail. And then we got people coming in this weekend, which is another developing phenomenon. I notice I'm starting to spend more and more of my weekends dealing in various ways in person with actual real live people, which is a good thing and a development that's long overdue. But still, at the end of the month, it constricts the hell out of my time. So I'm going to have to be a little less meticulous about this week's Radio Free Northwest than I might normally be. Actually, I did a Mike Harris show on Monday, and I was tempted to just spruce that up a bit and slap it up on the side as this week's Radio Free Northwest, but that's very sloppy practice. I don't like it, and I know you don't like it, so I won't do it. However, this week I'm going to have to fall back on a lot of pre-recorded stuff, and that includes not just our regulars like Andy and Gretchen, but also includes a four-way panel discussion we recorded when Charles Kraft was here. However, before we do get into that, I should give you a brief recap on some news stories we started following last week. Now, on the assassination of the head of the Colorado State Forced Labor Camp System, because that's largely what prisons in Obama's America are. What did I tell you last week? It turns out that the alleged shooter is a so-called white supremacist, whatever the hell that is. And furthermore, this so-called white supremacist is conveniently dead. The official story is that a 28-year-old ex-convict named Evan Abel rocks up one night on prison honcho Thomas Clements' doorstep. He shoots Clements. He then escapes so efficiently that no one can positively identify and replace him at the scene. After which, he drives to Texas, and about 36 hours later, he pulls up on some rural road down there beside a deputy. He opens fire on the deputy without provocation and wounds him, kind of his way of saying, "Hey, look at me, over here, here I am." Then he takes off, leading other Texas cops on a long high-speed chase, after which he suddenly turns, waves his gun around in the air, and then he's shot down by about half a dozen of them. And after this, Abel is then taken to the local hospital, where his organs are harvested while he's in a coma, even before he's officially pronounced dead. Now, our lords and masters claim that they know Abel killed the prison commandant because the ejector markings on the shell casings of his gun allegedly match casings found at the scene in Colorado. But so far as they've announced, there's been no actual ballistic match on any of the slugs. Oh, and he had quote-unquote bomb-making materials in his car. Now, that's always a favorite, since virtually any kind of substance or electronic bits and pieces can be described as bomb-making materials. Now, this is the official story so far. I'm sure they'll get it properly tweaked and all the dots connected and the gaps neatly filled in before they trot it out of the showroom. Now, there are a few weird loose ends that pique the interest, such as the fact that Evan Abel's father is a very prominent corporate attorney in Colorado named Jack Abel, and the father is a personal friend and crony of the Colorado governor. But I'm sure all these little anomalies will be discreetly airbrushed out of the picture by showtime. Nor is it clear exactly what Evan Abel's so-called white supremacy consisted of. Now, he may or may not have been a member of a gang in prison, but as anyone who's ever been inside can tell you, that actually means very little, because membership in a gang for a young white male in those infernos can be a matter of life and death. Okay, look, for all I know, the official story may be the correct one. This guy Abel was a convicted armed robber. He's also suspected of killing a pizza delivery guy, and he was obviously no prize. He did something like 7 years in the Colorado system, most of it in solitary confinement, and that will mess up some guys' heads really bad. Apparently, his wealthy father also sent him to a tough love camp in Samoa when he was about 15. Now, most of our listeners aren't rich enough to know what those are, but they're private concentration camps where the wealthy power elite can stash their unruly kids out of sight. Most of them are outside the United States in places like Samoa or the Philippines or Mexico to keep the kids from getting access to the police or legal system here, and also so the kids can be tortured and abused in ways that would get the parents in trouble if they did it in this country. It's kind of like the capitalist version of extraordinary rendition, and like most prisons, if these kids were messed up going in, they're mad as March hares when they come out. So yeah, this guy Abel may have shot the Colorado prison commandant, if only in revenge for the 7 years of hell he endured. I'm not saying he didn't. What I'm saying is that the system has done what I said it would do. Within a matter of hours after the commandant's death, it has presented us with a nice, neat, and politically acceptable solution, as well as made an example out of an allegedly wicked and evil white racist to show that it is impossible to resist, and death is the wages of racist sin, yada, yada, yada. Now, if there is something else moving in the shade here, some piece of really nasty corruption in the Colorado state government or the forced labor empire, then we'll probably never know. Now, moving right along from the world of slave labor to the world of high finance, I assume that by now most of you have at least some vague awareness of what's going on in Cyprus, where the private savings accounts of both local people and foreigners are being looted to bail out the banks, up to 40% of the savings of people who have over a certain amount. Now it looks like two other European countries, Italy and Spain, are going to follow suit and seize the savings of their own people in the banks in order to pay off their crushing debts. So how long before the dictatorship here does it? Now you will note I ask how long before Obongo does it, not tries it, because our dictator has already learned that he can do whatever he wants, and no one will do anything at all about it. Not long, I suspect. The regime is already making noises about quote-unquote buying out Americans' 401k plans at 60 or 70 cents on the dollar. Okay, here's the Cliff Notes version. Western liberal democracy has been spending more than it takes in for several generations. The money has not been used for anything productive, but it's been pissed up against the wall in order to wage wars to seize petroleum and protect Israel. And first and foremost, it's been used to create racial and economic underclasses, which are dependent on government handouts and who will therefore continue to vote the liberals and Marxists into power, lest they lose their dole, children's allowances, food stamps, government housing, government health care, etc., etc. It's been a long tussle with laissez-faire capitalism, but Marxism Lite seems to have won in Europe and here in America since 2008. Now the bill is coming due, quite literally, and Western Zionist liberalism owes more than it can pay. Western Zionist liberalism can no longer keep recycling the same money through the same banks in the form of bonds and borrowing because the curse of usury keeps driving the bill up in the form of interest. So the Marxist-like governments of the West can no longer borrow. They can print money, and here in the United States, the Jew Ben Bernanke is printing money. But at least some of them have sense enough to understand that this will cause potentially lethal inflation, and so that's a last resort. So, what do? They must seize the last remaining reserves of wealth in private hands, and that is the savings of middle-aged and elderly white people. This will only be a temporary fix, of course, but then our lords and masters have never been renowned for serious forethought on anything. Once they've killed the goose that lays the golden eggs, they'll be right back where they are, but they don't care so long as they can kick the can down the road and keep the system hobbling along for a few more years, and thus keep their own wealth and power intact for those few more years. As for the middle-aged and elderly white people whose life savings are being stolen, to hell with them. They've already shown that they won't revolt with force of arms, and democracy ensures that they will remain helpless, like so many wretched flies caught in a spider's web.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. I've received mixed reactions to my talk on anti-organization tactics and tendencies in the movement. One of our friends in England didn't quite see eye to eye with me on the subject and followed up. We took the discussion to the party message board for the sake of those who might be interested. He's since responded and I followed up, but in doing so it occurred to me that I've not been exactly clear in my reasons for starting that discussion to begin with. I expect any reaction to my talking points to be geared towards the waking people up chat, which ended up being the case. What I didn't expect to have happen is the exact conversation that took place. That conversation was due mostly to my being indirect and unclear with my meaning. Even in the message board discussion, I cautioned those who might respond that in order to address their concerns, I would have to be direct. In retrospect, it wasn't so bad, but it was rough enough. I'm not opposed to confrontation, but I don't care to insult someone's behavior if it's not needed. As it turns out, it wasn't. This particular friend of ours is elderly, ill, and obviously not going to migrate. He's quite open about that fact, so I don't have to deal with him like I do some others. Nevertheless, some level of critique was involved. Before I go any further, I need to explain precisely why I harp on topics like this. The party regularly talks about this character issue and tries to get those in the white nationalist movement to deal with their own character issues. That's what I was working up to in my discussion of anti-organization methods of handling oneself. To be more clear, each of us has oriented ourselves in a certain way towards our race and the way we claim to be an active service of such. I hate to come across like a jerk to an older gentleman across the pond for the sake of coming across like a jerk, but at this point, it ought to be clear that's not what I'm about. All told, I'm not sure this fellow had in mind the same thing I did when I spoke about waking people up, but something else interesting happened. Regardless of our meanings, there was still the insistence that we try to wake people up. I asked specific questions about what the term even means, and I got no answers. I pointed out logical concerns with implications of what it means to be asleep, and of course, I got no answers to that either. The same issues crept up in the response, though, and that was a little bit upsetting. I had wanted a little bit of chat out of the interaction. Be that as it may, I mostly got what I needed. As with the other anti-organization tactics I brought up, there was the ever-present need to do something, associated with this guy's version of waking people up. To his credit, his version of said useless activity really panned out to making sure people who need information have it, which, in all fairness, isn't inane like garden variety waking people up. However, this frantic desire to make sure we're doing something is the root of all movement anti-organization tactics. The ability to say a person is doing something is the placebo used by anti-migration types to justify their lack of participation in the Northwest Imperative. In fact, I've been told by sad sacks on various media outlets that I'm clearly uneducated racially or otherwise out of the loop on some big secret because I'm not cramming a particular religion down my friends' throats, attacking said religion, posting quotes from the protocols of the Elders of Zion, or nattering on and on and on about how Zog is going to kill us all the next time Zog is supposedly going to kill us all. And hey, they've got a right to be mad at me after all those times the Second Coming happened, and all those times Zog rounded us up and sent us to camps, and all those times the economy collapsed, and we rebuilt it so it could collapse again the month following. Yeah, I'm horrible, all right. And for those of you who think I'm mocking your version of Christianity, or any version of Christianity, save it. I don't want to hear from you. We've got a problem in the movement, and not just with Christianity, where lots of religious people don't even bother to do racial work since they're happy waiting for their version of the apocalypse. I don't have a problem with religion, but I do have a problem with those of you who are so far gone that you think you're doing our race a favor by doomsaying every 5 minutes. But then again, that's because you're not willing to do anything else. Which brings me back to my main point. The movement is in a sorry state when most of our people are willing to work themselves up into a near panic over doing something. The party offers something to do in the form of either migration or helping create units in the homeland. Further, if you migrate correctly, you'll have other comrades in your area that you can talk to on a face-to-face basis. This could all happen, sure, but it seems as though most of us don't want to bother to change the way we've organized ourselves. The very first thing I had to do when I decided to come home was confront the person I had been up to that point and decide what about myself needed to change. It's going to be different for each person, but the common element will always be the decision to critically analyze past and current behavior for its motivation and effectiveness. This is applicable to the whole movement, not just individuals. The movement's past and current behavior has been motivated by the desire to avoid actual responsibility and effort in favor of obsessing over things that end up not mattering, just like the anti-organization orientations I've spoken about in the past. To be completely direct, as I failed to be before, the reason movement people are so trained in on the bad behavior is that they've got nothing to do without it. We all know that's not really true, but getting someone to admit it still seems to be rougher going than it ought. I have to feel a little bad about giving the British guy grief since there's not much he can actually do, but the rest of you should consider yourselves directly responsible for what I'm saying. In the past, on RFN, I made allusion to the mental state required to constantly exist in one of these anti-organization mindsets. The movement is the world's worst addiction, and unless you're getting a fix somehow, you're miserable. So you can either participate in the Northwest Imperative or come up with a substitute, which eventually leaves you wanting more. As obvious as that seems, the resistance a person can put up to a real task with real responsibility knows no end. Usually, this takes the form of imagining a racial activity other than party participation to be of some value. But an honest, unbiased examination of the past and its results should inform all of us otherwise. These activities, done for too long, in light of their effect on a person, usually result in some sort of unhealthy attachment to them. Then, this unhealthy behavior becomes associated with validating the bad behavior. If only I could wake people up. If only I could tell everyone what just dropped into my email. If only Zog would finally fall apart. If only Deity X would appear in the clouds. If only someone else would do the work for me. No kidding, guys. I've been told off on Facebook more than once when it became obvious I wasn't going to participate in any anti-organization hijinks and mope around until some Event X materialized out of thin air. These people's final message to me is always some variation on, "Mark my words, you'll remember this conversation when Event X happens and you'll know I was right." They're going to repeat that more times than I care to imagine, and they'll never have a single thing to show for it. I've interrupted many a pity party with the good news that an actual solution to the genocide of the white race exists, only to be told, that looks too hard, so we're just going to continue the pity party in the hope that something changes. Really, that's about how it goes. The movement is split between those participating in the Northwest Imperative and those coming up with reasons not to do so. I hope this is sinking in, guys, because I'm really running out of ways to paint the broader picture for you. Hail victory.
Tonight I'd like to discuss a book about Nathan Bedford Forrest by Jack Hurst. Nathan Bedford Forrest was always a man of action, and it tells initially in the first chapter, it'll tell you about these two stories where at one point there are these two women that are stuck in a carriage. They're kind of stuck in a stream, and he has to rescue them, and one of them he ends up proposing to. Marianne Montgomery. At first, there's some concern because she's just this nice Christian woman, and Forrest says, well, if I marry her, I'll be reformed. And there's also a story about him hunting down and killing a panther and saving parts of its hide so that he can show off his deed of derring do. When Forrest decided to go into a profession, he decided to become a full-time slave trader. This was somewhat unusual because a lot of Southern men were slave traders part-time, but he wanted to be full-time, and he went into a lot of business partnerships, but he had trouble getting on with his business partners, and so he was always changing partners. Now, Forrest's policy as a slave trader was to always keep the mother and child together until the child was at least 10. And he was very strict about this rule, and other traders were not. The other thing that is disputed by historians is to what extent Forrest respected free Negroes who had been freed usually by some northern court, and whether he sold them or not, or whether that was more his partners, so that's somewhat disputed. Pretty much as soon as the Civil War starts, Forrest enlists. He enlists along with his son, and he fights in the southwestern part of the South, so he sees a lot of action. He gets injured 4 times. He has, at one point, a very serious musket ball wound. The musket almost severs his spine, but even so, he's able to get off his horse and walk to a doctor's office. So he was a really tough guy. He was a big man for his time. He was around 6 feet tall, maybe over 6 foot, which you really didn't have at that time. There were many instances where horses were shot out from under him, and he's very fortunate through the war, and he's always a very bold fighter. He uses the charge a great deal, and this comes actually from his childhood. There was an instance where he was thrown off a horse, and he was thrown into harm's way, and he found that sometimes by charging, the danger will recede. And so he used this tactic a great deal during the Civil War. He's very sympathetic towards Confederate sympathizers who have been imprisoned, and he's always trying to break them out of prison, and there are some great stories about that. He's always commandeering supplies from the Unionists. He's always making the Unionists think that there are more Confederate soldiers than there really are. So he's just a really fierce fighter, moves up through the ranks, becomes a major, and is suggested to become a major general. But he refuses the rank of major general because he's more interested in winning. And he uses whatever techniques that he has to use. He's very unconventional on the battlefield. In fact, his tactics are still studied today by any kind of military strategist. Eventually, he has to surrender. The cause is lost, and he has to return to his home in Tennessee. At first, he tries to be very penitent and very much into his capitulation of going along with whatever he needs to go along with, but he really doesn't stay that way for long. In fact, he even corresponds with a friend about a possible invasion of Mexico, but of course, that's probably just something that he thinks about to try to keep his spirits up. In 1866, he ends up finding out about a new organization, and that would be the Klan. And so he joins the Klan. Now, a lot of the reason why he does that is because during Reconstruction in the South, Confederates such as Forrest, particularly those fought hard on the side of the Confederacy, really could not participate in political life at all. In fact, he tries to be a delegate at a convention, and even that is controversial. So he has to have his own voice and ends up going into the Klan. So he's in the Klan for about 3 years. But he really finds that Klan tactics, which initially start out as just pranks and then become more serious, aren't really working very well. At this point, he's also trying to get involved in railroading. And he's really not doing very well financially because the South is in such shambles after the war. At around 1868, he starts to have a very profound personality change. Now, the reasons for this, it may have been brought about by Fort Pillow, which was something that went on during the Civil War. You have to understand that during the Civil War, Forrest was a very strong Confederate soldier, both mentally and physically. He becomes very enraged by the thought that the Union starts to arm Negro soldiers. Thought of an armed Negro soldier really enrages the Confederate Forrest. What happens is at Fort Pillow, he supposedly gives the order to take prisoners. And so he fights fiercely, kills a lot of Negroes that are even attempting to surrender or supposedly has them killed. You have to understand, he has a unit, so it's not just him, it's his whole unit. This Fort Pillow massacre is never lived down, and it is to the horror of any of the liberal thinkers, any of the radical Republicans. You have to remember, in this time, Republicans were actually the liberals, and that actually Lincoln was Republican. So for a long time, the South was solidly Democratic, and this was true, gosh, probably even until the 1960s or so. I mean, for a long time in the South, they say you would vote for a yellow dog before you would vote Republican. So he does get very involved with the Democratic Party, for example. And so what happens is when he undergoes this personality change, instead of endorsing the Klan, he starts to endorse the Democrats. At around this time, at around 1968 and afterwards, he becomes a Christian, whereas he was never religious before. And he also sells his home and he moves into a log cabin where he also helps to rehabilitate prisoners. So prisoner rehabilitation becomes his business at the end of his life. So it goes to show you never know how someone's life is going to turn out until, as Harold says, they're safely dead. So I hope you enjoyed this review. You know, I found it fascinating. It turns out that some of Forrest's descendants end up going into the Klan, even though Forrest encouraged the Klan to disband and basically said that the Klan had a certain mission, completed its mission, and now just go and be sort of a Democrat. So I hope you enjoyed this review. Again, the title is Nathan Bedford Forrest, a biography by Jack Hurst. So thank you for listening.
Okay, first music break. Our British comrade Arlen Brand has another original song for us. This is called Fame of a Dead Man's Deeds.
A bonny fire is a blessing to man, and also the sight of the sun. His hearty health, if he holds it well, and to live one's life without shame. The son of a king shall be silent and wise, and bold in battle as well. Glad and wholesome the hero be, till his dying day. Cattle die and kinsmen die, and you yourself will die. I know one thing that will never die, the fame of a dead man's deeds. Man thinks he aye will live if from fighting he flees, but age won't grant the gift of peace, though spears may spare his life. Cattle die and kinsmen die, and you yourself will die. I know one thing that will never die, the fame of a dead man's deeds. One thing I know that will never die, the fame of a dead man's deeds. Fame of a dead man's deeds.
Well, as last week, we had Seattle artist Charles Kraft on, and after we did the interview with Mr. Kraft, we had some guys come by, and we just had a sort of a little panel or BS discussion, and we decided we were going to record it and just let the chips fall where they may. So we've got Andy Donner from Seattle and Don from nearby, and so I guess we're just going to talk about whatever the spirit moves us to talk about. You guys heard most of Charles's interview about his problems with revisionism and his views becoming known and everything, right?
Oh, yes. Yep, definitely. And I just wanted to say that a few people, well, everybody who's listened to RFN has heard my story about when I started to realize that I had racial opinions. And one of the things that caused me to realize I had racial opinions were I'd seen pictures of some of Charles's work, and I thought it was really neat. I mean, especially the Hitler teapot. And normally, what you might call a normal person might react badly to that, and I didn't see a problem with that sort of art. And that, among other things, was one of the things that made me realize I have some opinions in a different direction. So, thank you, Charles.
You're welcome. Do you want to talk about the NVA plate that you made, or is that going to get you in more trouble?
Oh, well, I was invited to participate in an art show in a small gallery in Seattle in conjunction with a convention of ceramic teachers that was in town last year. And the theme for the show that they invited me to participate in was Cascadia, which is the name of a book that was written about the Pacific Northwest as a utopian ecological paradise.
They're also the left-wing equivalent of us. We're the right-wing separatists, and they're the left-wing separatists.
And I decided that I'd do a commemorative plate based on the cover of Harold Covington's book, The Brigade. And I happened to have a bayonet mold that I was using to create some other work. And I affixed a bayonet to the plate and proceeded to use the Northwest Volunteer Army logo on the blade of the bayonet and then the logo, the brigade cover for the plate. And I put that into the show, but I didn't hear back if anybody that came in to see it recognized it.
Either nobody did or everybody did, and they figured they better not say anything.
The curator did. The guy that asked me to do it knew what was up, but I don't think that he volunteered any information to these academics who may have wandered in and out of his shop.
I'm amazed. Actually, this is one of the things that encourages me. I find that my novels are getting a lot more well-known. I don't want to say that everybody in Seattle has read all five of them. Obviously, that's not true, but I'm starting to notice little bits of blue, white, and green here, there, and everywhere on bumper stickers and mysterious flags that appear and signs and whatnot. I don't know. Maybe I'm seeing something that's not there, but I think we're having a little bit of success in getting the message across.
Yeah, before I saw that one, my favorite one piece of your work was the surveillance camera, but I think this one tops that easily.
I did a surveillance CCTV camera on a stand that is covered in Delft blue floral patterns. It looks like your granny's china, but it's kind of sinister because it's a spy device surveillance.
Well, we are turning into sort of a 1984-style society. Right now, the United Kingdom, Britain, has literally a spy camera on every corner, and it's not just the big cities like Birmingham and Manchester anymore. They're getting into the villages now. We get some little picturesque village in Bedfordshire or something like Miss Marple used to live in, and you get out and walk around the little village square and you'll see the cameras hidden up there among the ancient oaks. And what's really scary is some of them are interactive. If you throw down a chewing gum wrapper or something, some voice will suddenly come out of the sky saying, "Hey, you over there, pick that up."
You're kidding me.
No, I'm not.
They got guys with microphones behind the cameras?
They're interactive. I don't know the degree to which Britain itself is covered by these things, but obviously it's more and more every year.
I was inspired to do the camera because of my visit to London. I mean, you're right. They're everywhere. But I haven't heard yet of them talking to people.
Well, that's probably just the latest development. The thing is that these cameras are starting to be set up in most American major cities. And of course, what happens when you do that is you get this whole class of people who have to monitor and service these cameras and sit there watching the screens. And so you've got a whole class of people that does nothing but get up in the morning and go to work where they are paid taxpayer dollars to sit there for 8 hours a day or however long their shift is and watch their fellow citizens to make sure that their behavior is conforming to whatever the state wants them to conform to. And I remember, you know, when I was growing up, we thought 1984 was a horrible piece of fiction. But I honestly can say that nobody ever thought that it could actually come true, and now it is.
Sounds like East Germany.
Oh, yeah. East Germany probably was as close to building a successful surveillance state as anybody's ever come. At one stage, it's estimated that one out of every three East German citizens was working as an informer or in some capacity for the Stasi, the secret police.
Have you ever heard that quote by William Burroughs about the perfect police state?
No.
It doesn't need any police.
Well, this is why we are forbidden to use certain words like nigger and faggot and beaner and God knows what else. Like Rush Limbaugh was jumped on because he called that Sandra Fluck woman a slut, which apparently, according to her own confession, due to her behavior, she was. But they're trying to ban these words and punish people for saying these words so that they won't think them. They are trying to control dissent by, in essence, making thought crime impossible because we will not have the language to formulate dissenting thoughts because we're so scared that we'll utter it and be punished through loss of social status or loss of job or whatever that we force ourselves not even to think these words. All of the stuff about, oh, these are offensive words, they must... No, it's not about that. It's about thought control.
Well, to quote my mother, I'm free, white, and 21, and I'll say what I damn well please.
And in some places right now, you would be... Well, in this country, you wouldn't be arrested for saying it. You might in Britain or Canada. But if you were to utter that in certain workplaces, whatnot, you would be fired. You would be subjected to all kinds of social sanctions, etc., just for simply uttering an old saying like that.
My difficulties with mainstream media began, if we go back to the beginning of last week's program, with Facebook and the social networking. I believe that Facebook was developed by DARPA. There was a movie that I got my hands on that I posted at my Facebook page that sort of told the story of how Facebook came about. And the social networking that's going on is another surveillance operation. And you better be careful about what you say on your Facebook page or on any of these other social networking sites because they're being watched by your teachers, maybe your parents, maybe the police department, maybe your boss. Mm-hmm. Or the human resources director of your company who is seeing what kind of a person you are.
Oh, yes. Right now, I can think of a number of criminal cases. Some of them were political, racial. Others were just outright criminal stuff. But the FBI got their leads or they got information that they used to put somebody in prison off somebody's Facebook site. I maintain several Facebook accounts under different names. They won't let me have one under my real name, but I'm always careful about what I say on there because everything on Facebook is monitored. Also, they use these network sites to direct public opinion. You've heard of this persona management software that allows somebody to maintain up to 16 separate accounts and personalities on the internet, and each one showing a different IP address, so it looks like that they're coming from different people. And a lot of this, I'm sure, is being used to manipulate opinion on Facebook and blog comments, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, there's also something called Megaphone, and that somehow multiplies a message and makes it look like it's coming in from a lot more people than it, mm-hmm. it really is.
Yeah.
I don't know the I'm not very savvy with a computer. I'm from a different generation, but they're using these apps to make it look as if the comments in certain places are coming in from a lot more people than it really exist.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Obama administration admits that they are using things like Twitter and other social media to shape and to guide opinion. And someone once said that they estimate that almost 20% of the Twitter casts or tweets or whatever during the election came from Democrats, Obama, or someone affiliated with the Obama campaign, etc. That's one of the ways that they won the election, if you want to say they won, besides vote fraud, is they literally flooded the social media with Democrat propaganda.
Well, they're doing the same in the Middle East with these color revolutions and Eastern Europe as well. Twitter messages and flash mob type protests going on, coordinated by intelligence officers sitting at desks in Virginia, for God's mm-hmm. sakes. It's very, very scary and interesting.
Well, what's interesting is that a lot of those revolutions seem to have gone awry because they put the Muslim Brotherhood in power. And the relationship between, say, Egypt and Israel have deteriorated quite significantly since Morsi took over. They're not quite finding Syria as easy a mouthful to chew as they thought they did. It looks like the Assad regime has a lot more staying power than they thought. But it's clear to me that what they were trying to do there is get rid of all these regimes that were officially anti-Israel and install more Israeli-friendly governments. But what they didn't realize was that the revolutionary movements in these countries were all infiltrated top to bottom by the Muslim Brotherhood. And so what they inadvertently did was install Muslim Brotherhood governments, including, you know, in cases like Libya, with actual bombing to help the so-called rebels, and they were installing anti-American regimes to do so. To me, it's funny as hell.
I can't believe that they hadn't worked that all out on paper with their logarithms before. They got those revolutions up and running.
What you have to bear in mind is that the people who control our society, the people who govern us, the people who tell us what to do and claim that they're so much better than we are in fact a bunch of incompetent idiots. They don't know what they're doing, and this gives me hope. You look at some of these television shows like 24, where you've got Jack Bauer and his girl Chloe running around with drones watching every move made on the street, and Jack Bauer can just flip out his cell phone and get somebody's whole biography in 60 seconds. And that they just, I think the intention of some of these shows is it's a form of intimidation to kind of convey to the American people, no, you can't ever revolt.
Oh.
You can't ever raise your hand against us because we're all powerful. We can see everything you do and we can follow you anywhere and blah, blah, blah. But in reality, this technology is only as good as the people they have using it. And I've had a lot of people tell me that my scenarios for revolution in the Northwest couldn't possibly work because, oh, they'd just follow you around with drones and they'd follow you with GPS indicators and you'd have satellite photos. No, no, no. Resistance is impossible. But I don't think that history shows that. The Iraqis and the Afghans and some other places where the U.S. has intervened, yeah, the satellites and the drones have been a danger, but the drones and all the satellite surveillance haven't defeated the Afghan Taliban, and they never defeated the Iraqi insurgents movement. And so it can be done if we can find within ourselves the courage to act. And I'm raving here. This is supposed to be a panel discussion.
Can it be done, Harold, between commercial breaks?
Well, no, that is exactly the problem. That is exactly the problem we have is that for so many people, life as a whole and all of these things is just something to be watched on an electronic screen. I think I was talking on RFN a few weeks ago. In a way, this will be an advantage. When the crisis finally comes, it will be the 5% of the people who support the resistance movement versus the 5% of the people who support the government and the regime to maintain their privileges. And the other 90% of the population will simply view the revolution as something to sit back and watch on their television and maybe with a bowl of nachos and a beer.
Oh, well, so as far as panel discussions go, I'm sort of curious, Charles, I've never had a hit piece done on me. Nobody's actually ever found me out in real life.
Give it time.
Fair enough. Weren't you were traveling when this happened, were you not?
Right, I was in India.
What is it like to come back here and have to deal with, like, what pointers could you give a person that has to deal with that?
These guys, or most of the people that are with us now, have never seen a media feeding frenzy. I have, and it's not fun, so maybe we can give them some pointers.
Well, you can make a decision to not speak to the media, or you can speak to them, and I decided that I would speak to anybody that wanted to interview me or have me speak about my martyrdom on the altar of political correctness, let's say. So, my advice, friends in the background have advised me to do this and do that. I'm weighing what they've told me I should do against what I've done, and maybe I've made a mistake by talking, digging a deeper hole for myself by continuing to speak with journalists and interviewers on internet podcast shows. If you have the same trouble I do, you can decide to do that or not to do that. My situation is a little bit unique because I'm a semi-public figure. I'm an artist and I am self-employed, so I don't like the work, but I sure love the boss.
Yeah. It helps to be self-employed because that way you don't have a paycheck that they can cut off.
Right.
They can't threaten you through your job. That what they can, of course, do is threaten you through your art because, in a sense, I think you're kind of dependent on the liberal hippy-dippy art world for your sustenance, so they can probably hit you there. I'm kind of lucky in that I'm a writer and not an artist, and we have this print-per-order publishing, and I can also use the internet to publish and so forth, and there are enough people who like my writing so that they support my work, so I can kind of self-market. I don't know if that would really apply to you so much.
Yeah, it applies to me, and now that I've been cut off from some of my income stream, which in the past had depended on lecturing on college campuses, I've received residencies and grants from public and private foundations that support the arts. I believe that this is not going to be possible for me any longer. So I'm beefing up my presence on the internet with a new website, and people that want to find me can come directly to that place and discuss business with me there, or they can visit the galleries that still represent me. And as I said, it's an easier row for me to hope being self-employed. I really pity the person that this happens to that is holding down a job.
It also really hurts if you have a family and children. It helps if you have what they call in law enforcement a short tail, no family. Someone once said that he who has a family and loved ones gives hostages to fortune. It helps if you have no hostages to fortune.
Yeah, that about covered it. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Do you guys have any questions about Holocaust history that you'd like to pitch at me?
Well, the thing is, I'm kind of...
Maybe we should not just belabor the whole thing for a second hour.
Well, I make no bones about my being a National Socialist, and to paraphrase Love Story, being a Nazi means never having to say you're sorry. So when people come at me saying, oh, you're a Nazi, you're a racist, I say, well, duh. But being a National Socialist, I am kind of in a unique position whereby during my younger days, I was able to meet with and speak with on a very frank basis a lot of the old veterans of the Axis side in World War II, not only in this country, but in South Africa and Britain and elsewhere. I've talked with everybody from an old Irish blue shirt who fought in the Spanish Civil War on the side of General O'Duffy to a Lithuanian SS man in Market Park in Chicago, and an old former U-boat captain and so forth. And when I talk to these old guys, I would ask them sometimes, a good example, I've mentioned this on RFN before, but this old Lithuanian guy I met in Marquette Park, he was introduced to me in a bar by a guy named Reza Darich, and he knew that I was the new head of the party in Chicago, and he knew that he could speak to me without getting victimized by all kinds of retaliation. So after about the third St. Pauli girl, I asked him, I said, look, you were there, tell me, what actually happened? Did you guys really massacre all these Jews? And I won't attempt to reproduce what he said, but basically what you have to understand is that in many cases, the things that supposedly happened as part of the Holocaust legend were physically impossible. He was talking about the way the rail lines worked, and there were two main rail lines going into Russia, one running through the south, down through the Ukraine, through Kiev, the other running up northwise through Leningrad, down to Moscow, and so forth. And the Germans had to keep those rail lines open. They simply did not have the rolling stock or the logistics to round up hundreds of thousands of Jews and put them on trains and send them back to Auschwitz. The idea is ridiculous.
Well, they've moved the goalpost, you know, Harold, and about 83 decided that the camps in Germany, where we've been told they had gassing facilities, were no longer death camps.
Yeah.
They moved them down to Poland, to the Action Reinhardt camps. Treblinka, Sobibor, Majdanek, and Auschwitz. Now they're trying to rebrand the Holocaust as a Holocaust by bullets.
Okay.
They've got a French priest that went out and is claiming to have found mass graves throughout Eastern Europe.
Yeah, that's, of course, some of those could be Russians if they...
Well, they won't open the graves because of this Jewish law, religious law disturbing the dead. So there's no forensic evidence on those pits and what's in them. The moment they find somebody in them is the moment the rabbi comes and says, that's it.
Okay, we need to take another music break here. It strikes me that we haven't had any saga on this show for a while.
And too late.
Sounds to me like they finally figured out that they're not going to be able to keep up this gas chamber business for too much longer, I think. So in other words, like they're trying to segue from gas chamber to alleged bullets.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, I'll tell you where you do get bullet massacres. Right now, to this day, throughout the former Soviet Union, it is by no means unusual for them to be building a new car park or a department store or a freeway or something like that, and the bulldozers will be coming along, and all of a sudden they turn up 5, 10, 15, 20,000 skeletons at a time, and all of the skulls have that little bullet hole in the back of the head, the NKVD execution shot. Stalin murdered literally, I mean,
nothing. Tito murdered. Yeah, right. Tens of thousands of POWs at the end of the war. They were sent back from Bleiburg into Yugoslavia. And on their way back to their homes in Croatia and Slovenia, Serbia, wherever they came from, they were dispatched. And when I was in Yugoslavia, ex-Yugoslavia, they had just begun to talk about these mass graves that they were unearthing with, as you say, tens of thousands of bodies in them, not Jews.
Like the Katyn Forest Massacre in the early 1940s, when the Germans found that site, the first thing they did was call in the International Red Cross, and they cordoned off the area, and they said, look, we know damn well we're going to get accused of doing this, but we did not. We want you guys to come up here from Switzerland, from the Red Cross, and be with us while we excavate this site. And there's, what, 7,000-8,000 Polish officers that had been murdered by Stalin. But, of course, the Germans were accused originally of doing it, and it wasn't until almost about maybe 20 years ago when Glasnost and Perestroika finally came along that the Russians admitted to doing this. I mean, I'm, as you note from my, you know, book stand here and some other things, I'm kind of a Stalin aficionado, so I find it just insane that there are people, respectable academic types, professors at all the universities in this country who will just denounce Hitler as this horrible, wicked, genocidal monster, and at the same time will defend Joseph Stalin as a hero of the people. And yeah, maybe he was kind of crude at times. Maybe he did kill a few million people, but it was necessary for the greater good and to fight the evil Nazis.
You have to break an egg to make an omelet.
Right, yeah. And Stalin probably has to be the greatest mass murderer of all times because the number of people he killed through his deliberate famine, through the various purges in the 1930s in the Civil War when he was, you know, commissar for one of the armies on the Eastern Front and so forth and so on. And the Russians who died through incompetence during the Second World War because he was a lousy general. If you want to tote up the number of deaths that this one man is responsible for as a person because of either his cruelty or his policy or his just stupidity, no one knows. 30 million, 40 million, 50 million. It's beyond calculation.
Not to mention the Gulag system and everybody that died there in these labor camps.
Mm-hmm. Oh, exactly. It's all part of this incredible total. To me, the fascination with Stalin is not with Stalin himself, although he was in many ways a very incredible guy. I mean, the guy was born the son of a slave, and he literally rose to be the greatest tyrant the world has ever seen. It's an incredibly impressive, if thoroughly vile, story. But the whole idea of Soviet Russia under Stalin, when you are literally living in a mad world. I think the best short fictional piece I ever did was one called The Madman in Marina, which is set in the time of Stalin. And I once had, I think, probably the greatest compliment I've ever been paid. Some Russian guy emailed me and says, oh, I know, your name isn't Covington. You're not really an American. I read this story and you've got to be a Russian. You're posing as an American for some reason because only a Russian could write this story, which I consider to be a very great tribute to my work, but just the mentality of people living in that kind of society, which was literally insane and run by criminals. I mean, we use that expression over here for Obama, but in Russia, it was just I can't imagine a world like that, which is possibly one of the reasons I'm, you know, so fascinated by it, but it existed. It was real. And we have today people who will defend that insane monster and yet attack Adolf Hitler for things that he never did. And I'm talking too much. I'm babbling.
Well, so here's another question related to your experience, Charles. When, I mean, obviously we heard the interview, so we know about what was going on, and we know that, you know, you've been all over the world with this topic. What specifically, because I rag on people for, you know, the whole wake people up thing and the idea that we can just flash some fact in front of someone's face and make them think like we do, and I mean, we can flash facts in reality. We can flash facts all we want in front of someone, and they won't care. What really got you interested in the topic?
Which topic are you talking about?
I mean, the Holocaust revision specifically. What made you pay attention and what made you decide this was something that you needed to devote time to?
Well, the Trefa case. I picked up a book by, I think his name is Howard Bloom. It was called Nazis in America. It was a piece of pulp. And there was a chapter in there on this Romanian bishop. And the thing that got me going was that the author was saying that the Iron Guard in Romania were more vicious than the Nazis in Germany. And that the Germans had to rein them in. And I thought, God, that must be awful.
Just to interpose here, I've talked to Third Reich veterans. That, interestingly enough, is one of the things some of them did say when I was talking about, well, did you really kill all these Jews? They would say, well, okay, well, yeah, some Jews were killed when we went into certain villages in Russia or in Poland, etc., but it wasn't us that was doing it. It was the local people who, was the minute the communists or the local bully boys got off their backs, the first thing they did was
reprisals
against the Jews. And said in some cases, the German army actually had to intervene to stop them from rioting and lynching all the Jews in the village.
Well, there's also that, and then there's the partisan warfare. Lots of Jewish partisans taken out because of their, you know, the Geneva Convention says that combatants have to wear a uniform. Mm-hmm. These people are running around without uniforms. They're sabotaging the German army as it moves east. Mm-hmm. And it's just like if you remember Vietnam and May Lai, mm-hmm. the Germans would take out, I believe, 10 for every officer that a partisan killed. They would go in and they would execute 10. People don't factor that into this story that there were brigades of Jewish partisans that were attacking the Germans.
Communism was very largely a Jewish phenomenon, and the Jews were very prominent in the Communist Party. You may have heard of the infamous SS action groups, the Einsatzgruppen. Well, this old Lithuanian guy I mentioned was talking about them, and he said what they were kind of like ranger battalions or special ops units whose jobs were to go up and down those rail lines I mentioned and prevent the sabotage of the railroads and basically make sure that the German supply lines stayed open, because you got these rail lines that are just long, you know, hundreds of miles long going into the steppes and whatnot, that they're both sides actually depended on to move their men and material, and the Germans had to make sure that the rail system was functioning and prevent partisans from blowing up the bridges and derailing the trains and that sort of stuff. And basically the way this old guy told it, yeah, they were pretty badass, and when they caught partisans, they either shot them or interrogated them and then shot them. Look, nobody is claiming that World War II was a picnic for anybody, and on the Eastern Front especially, it was bloody, it was bitter, it was nasty. Nobody is claiming any different. And I'm sure I would not have wanted to be a Jew in Auschwitz or a Jewish partisan that had been captured by the SS on the Eastern Front. But this idea of some deliberate program, like, for instance, they've never found any order from either Hitler or Himmler or anyone that said, okay, you will round up all the Jews and you will kill them all.
Well, why? They had a war to fight. It seems ridiculous that they would not stop but use the rolling stock to perpetrate a genocide. I mean,
no, they didn't. And this is, like I said, what this old guy was telling me. Also, he told me something very interesting, which I think applies to a large part of these atrocity stories. He said, well, yeah, when we caught Jews, they tended to go one way, but we didn't catch that many Jews because the minute they heard the SS was coming, they got the hell out.
Well, what about this new news that we've just been delivered about the Holocaust and the possibility that the numbers are double what we thought they were?
I saw that. There were supposedly 30,000 concentration camps or something insane like
crazy. But listen,
one on every block in Germany.
Yeah. I think what they're doing there is they've started to realize that the Holocaust myth as advertised for the past 50 years is starting to come apart.
Well, they're overplaying their hand with this BS. there were Jews in the cities that were bombed back to the Stone Age by the Allies. So some of the missing Jews that we hear about were casualties of air raids.
Well, there were Jews, a small number, admittedly, but there were Jews who lived normal lives in Berlin right through the entire war.
Of course. There was a Jewish hospital that was standing when the Russian army arrived.
But their minds are made up. There was a Holocaust, so don't try to confuse them with facts.
Well, I recently have also seen that 25,000, 30,000, whatever concentration camp thing, and that news got pushed pretty heavily right when it came out. And I suspect, and this is just the way my mind works, I would look at that and say that the system media is expecting something else to come out, and they're smoke screening right now with the intent of being able to say, oh, whoever's saying that other thing is wrong because we just found this out.
I don't know what they could find that anyone would listen to. Some years ago, they discovered in Russian archives the actual honest-to-God records and death ledgers or whatever for the Auschwitz concentration camp, because Auschwitz was quote-unquote liberated by the Russians, and the Russians just hauled away everything. And then they didn't allow people to get access to them for God knows
10
how
years.
Years.
Yeah. Nobody could. It was behind the Iron Curtain.
Yeah. So
they had 10 years to get this story in place for the Action Reinhardt camps. Yeah.
But when some scholar finally dug out these medical records or death records for Auschwitz, it showed all the deaths in the camp from 1942 until 45. See, Auschwitz wasn't really open for all that long. You know, Dachau was founded in 1933. It was the first camp that Hitler used to intern his dissidents in. And odd enough, one of the reasons he made a special camp for it was felt at the time in the European tradition that it was not right to put a political prisoner in the same prison with common criminals, because a political prisoner actually had a lot more status. Anyway, turns out, long story short, the actual number of Jewish inmates, according to the camp records, who died in Auschwitz during that time was about 90,000. Now, that's a lot of deaths, but you have to bear in mind that there was starvation, there was typhus, there was
old age.
Old age. There was probably conditions were not too cool for these inmates. Like I say, no one is claiming that Auschwitz was a...
It was a city. It was 360,000 inmates or something like that.
Yeah, there was a lot of people.
Like a city.
It had a swimming pool.
Yeah. And a lot of people went through the camp as well. Like, for instance,
it was attached to a rubber factory.
Yeah, Bunor, I think it was, artificial rubber. It was just a general labor camp for factory work. Yeah, the Germans did tend to seize enemy aliens and use them as factory laborers.
Forced labor.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, no one says that was cool. But as this idea that there was a deliberate plan to exterminate all the Jews of Europe by putting them in gas chambers and making lampshades and soap out of them, it's just absurd.
Well, do you know who C.D. Jackson was?
Doesn't ring a bell.
Well, he was at Buchenwald during the liberation. He was Eisenhower's intelligence advisor. He was also part of a very exclusive and very small and secret intelligence unit within the political warfare executive, which was part of the British intelligence. William S. Paley, the head of NBC, was one of two Americans in that unit with C.D. Jackson, who became later the editor of Time, Life, and Fortune. He was Henry Luce's right-hand guy. Then there were these other black ops Englishmen that were involved in spreading disinformation during the war. There was a town near Buchenwald called Weimar, and they marched the citizens in so Billy Wilder could photograph them, looking at a table full of these atrocity objects that included the lampshade, two shrunken heads, some bones, and some organs in pickle jars,
As an aside, real quick, if anyone is curious precisely what's being discussed, you can get a video on the internet called One Third of the Holocaust, and they actually have footage of this thing taking place.
With Billy Wilder accidentally stepping into a frame and then stepping back out.
I know that there were some atrocity photos of alleged murders on the Eastern Front, et cetera, that were later identified as air raid victims from the Spanish Civil War, and they're just...
Well, those bodies laid out at Peñamonde. That was bombed by the Allies. Those are casualties from Allied bombing.
Yeah.
And they want us to believe that these were inmates that were starved to death.
Well, you know the famous picture of a guy, allegedly a Nazi stormtrooper or something, who's very blurry with his rifle up and some mother holding her child
about to be shot. He's shooting at something in the distance.
Well, also the guy...
Past that woman and her baby.
Yeah, also the guy's wearing a Russian uniform. So much of this so-called evidence for the Holocaust simply does not stand up to any any kind of critical examination. And I can see, in a way, once you accept it, like I said, the system has to have their Holocaust. They cannot, dare not let it get undermined. I can, in a way, kind of see why they brought in all these laws in Europe locking people up, because if this were ever subjected to any kind of critical, historical, or scholarly examination, it just wouldn't stand up.
It
didn't happen.
Well, it seems to be, and it seems they have an industry of these books. And every year I look at my issues of the London Review of Books or the New York Review of Books, and if you going through the advertisements of the academic presses, there's three or four academic studies of the Holocaust published by university presses annually. I mean, it's an industry. I don't know how these guys can live with themselves. I mean, I really don't, because the evidence, like you said, for this final solution just doesn't exist. But and yet they're writing about it more and more every year. The body of literature about it grows as the event itself recedes into time.
Well, it's also become an industry. Now, you know, a lot of these so-called authors have been proven to be fakes, like some Jewish woman who claimed that she was raised by wolves while the SS was looking for her.
There's different levels of Holocaust literature. I mean, there's that level, and then there's the academic level.
Yeah.
And I'm always amazed at professors and PhDs in these Holocaust studies departments coming up with so much information about these events with so little evidence for a final solution. I mean, the whole premise is that this was not a pre-planned, but an operation, premeditated.
Norman Finkelstein, a Jew himself, an academic Jew, excoriated it, wrote books about it, spoke out about this Holocaust industry as an industry. And based upon what got him started, of course, was his parents were in one of these death camps, and gee, they didn't die, and they also told him that wasn't the way it was.
And Finkelstein also got crucified for his trouble, too, by the world Jewish establishment.
Also, he mentioned that the reparations that were being collected by various Jewish associations and groups that were supposed to be dispersed to the survivors, the trickle-down was not enough for Norman Finkelstein. He put his finger on some financial chicanery, you know, that was going on with these agencies that are supposed to be distributing the monies that are given to them for Holocaust survivors. And there's one in New York. These guys got caught red-handed just skimming and skimming and skimming. Mm. Nothing happens to anybody.
Oh, yeah. It's a financial racket. It's like the Jews say, there's no business like show of business. There was an Italian Jew about 3 or 4 years ago who wrote a book, and unfortunately I cannot remember this guy's name off the top of my head, just to show you how any kind of revisionism can get you in trouble. He wrote a book on Jewish ritual murder in the Middle Ages, and he went over various case histories. I think that's it.
The Italian?
Could be,
the son of the rabbi.
Yeah, right. And he says, well, yeah, it appears, you know, okay, some of this was, you know, Christian propaganda, and some of it was a hoax and so forth. But, well, there does seem to be some evidence that our Jewish ancestors did a little bit of sacrificing of Gentile children and mixing it with matzah. Yeah, some of it does seem to be
true. Well, it's Kabbalistic black magic. Uh-huh. That's where some of this stuff that Aleister Crowley was into.
This guy got stomped on. He got in a lot of trouble for it, I know.
Farrasson was the guy who really...
No, Farrasson was assaulted, but I think this Italian guy was...
The Italian guy took his book off the market, and he didn't make an apology, really, but he sort of just disappeared. I can't remember.
Became an unperson.
Well, yeah, that's one thing about the tribe is that when you're a member of the tribe and they turn their back on you, that's really a bad thing.
I didn't know this until some time back, but Jews can actually excommunicate each other.
They do it. Yeah. And the fathers will excommunicate a son. And it's very, very hurtful to someone in that position. And, you know, Goldstone, in that report that he did for the UN on atrocities, human rights violations in the last, the Cast Lead operation, you know, this last war with
Lebanon. Gaza.
He went back after, I think it was about a year and a half, and restated his position because in the Washington Times, the Washington Post said that he hadn't found as many violations as he had before. And he did this because he was losing face with his friends.
The Goldstone report.
Goldstone.
I read Haaretz and the Jerusalem Post and Israel News and other Israeli papers, and they damn nail Goldstone to the floor practically. They hated him so bad because of that report. We'll be right back. Okay, I am running way, way long with that panel discussion, and so I'm going to have to go ahead and close this one out. I apologize for my unseemly haste this week, but just bear in mind that it's a good thing that I'm so damn busy. The Northwest Imperative is moving forward, and there's going to be growing pains. But for now, our time is up, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98104, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anaban. Freedom.